It's the biggest election night left before the midterms as voters cast their ballots in five states, testing the limits of Republicans' faith in former President Trump and both parties' vision for the future. Plus, inside the operation that took out bin Laden's successor, new reporting and new reaction amid the aftermath and what it all means for the future of U.S. national security. And a war of words between the U.S. and China, rising tensions as House Speaker Nancy Pelosi touches down on her historic trip to Taiwan. Welcome to Meet the Press Now. I'm Kristen Welker. If it's Tuesday, voters are voting on this election day in America, with polls open for another few hours in Michigan, Missouri, Kansas, Arizona, and Washington State. It's the biggest primary night so far this summer. Kansas voters are casting the first ballots on abortion since the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade. And Republican voters around the country are making choices that will test the limits of former President Trump's power over the party. The Republican gubernatorial primaries in Arizona and Michigan both feature candidates who have followed Mr. Trump's lead and baselessly questioned the legitimacy of the 2020 election, including one in Michigan who was arrested for being at the Capitol on January 6th, and one in Arizona who says the state's top election official should be in jail. Now, also on the ballot tonight, three Republican members of Congress who voted to impeach the former president. All three are facing Trump-backed primary challengers. Michigan's Pete Meyer told NBC News today that he doesn't regret the hard votes he's taken, even if they've upset voters in his own party.
I think it's important that we have somebody who is willing to do the hard work, but also tell the truth and be straightforward and honest with the people of West Michigan. That is what I've committed to do. That is what we have done so far in office. And that has led to some unpopular decisions at times, some difficult votes. But at the end of the day, I think the people of West Michigan deserve nothing less than transparency and honesty from their elected officials.
Little bit of defiance on this election day there. And then there is the Missouri Senate election, where the former president made what can only be described as a farce of an endorsement late yesterday, giving his nod to, quote, Eric, leaving it up to voters to decide if he meant Eric Greitens or Eric Schmidt, the two frontrunners in the race. Both Erics claimed the endorsement as their own. Let's turn now to our full team of NBC News reporters for what we can expect tonight. Yamiche Alcindor is in St. Louis, Missouri. Vaughn Hilliard is in Phoenix, Arizona. And Steve Kornacki is, of course, at the big board. Shaq Brewster is just outside of Grand Rapids, Michigan, and will join us in just a moment. You have all been incredibly busy, and we appreciate your joining us. And Yamiche, I want to start with you there. Talk to me about this dual endorsement, the two Erics. What has the reaction been there, and the fact that both Erics are claiming this endorsement as their own? How is that impacting these final hours of the race?
Well, Kristen, you could call it the battle of the Erics. Former President Trump has really inserted chaos into this Missouri Senate primary for the Republican race, of course. Both candidates, Eric Schmidt, who is the Missouri Attorney General, as well as Eric Greitens, who is the former embattled governor, they are both vying for the endorsement of President Trump, and they are both hoping to replace Roy Blunt, who is retiring from the U.S. Senate as a Republican. What you see here and what you alluded to is that both Erics are saying that the endorsement from President Trump, which said Eric all caps, but no actual last name, was really meant to go to them. So we've talked to both of the men, both of their campaigns, rather, and they both told us that they have talked to former President Trump after this endorsement announcement, and both of them say that they thanked the former president for his endorsement. I want to now play for you when I talked to Eric Greitens. This was a few hours after the endorsement announcement last night. I asked him, why are you so certain that former President Trump is talking about you when he says Eric with no last name? Take a listen. What makes you so clear that it's you and not the other Erics in this race?
Yes, ma'am. I think that it's incredibly clear because he was very clear. He wants a MAGA champion. Everybody here knows I've been behind President Trump, stood behind him on election integrity. I've stood up for our police officers. I've stood up for our veterans. And when President Trump said he wants a fighter for our veterans, it was very clear he's talking about me.
Now, sources tell us at NBC that this is intentional on the part of former President Trump. He wanted to really leave some vagueness here so that no matter what Eric wins, he will be able to claim victory. We should note that, of course, Eric Schmidt is someone who was seen as a moderate Republican, that of course is the Missouri Attorney General, but who really tried to tack right in order to get former President Trump's blessing. And on the other side, you have Eric Greitens, who has the support of Donald Trump Jr. ever since on the Jr. There's a lot of thinking that maybe the father was trying to follow his son in supporting Eric Greitens. I should also note that I talked to some voters here who say that they are really troubled by how much influence former President Trump is having in this race. One voter told me that they think that President Trump is being seen as a, quote, God, her words, not mine. And that really these candidates need to be more focused on middle class issues, need to be more focused on helping out people in the state and not on chasing the Trump endorsement. But Kristen, it tells you how much power the former president is wielding here. And we'll have to watch to see what happens if he ever clarifies. But as of now, in this moment, he has not clarified which Eric he's talking about. And one other quick note, there is a third Eric in this race. He's not a leading candidate, but I have to mention him because his name is Eric. Kristen.
You're absolutely right. I'm glad you did. And Yamiche, I really appreciate it. I know you have a lot of other hits today, so thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it. Von Hilliard, let me talk to you. You were at an event late last night, which was basically a Trump event. He wasn't there in person, but this was to bolster the Trump slate of candidates, right? Tell us about this event. And again, just picking up on the point that Yamiche makes, tonight is really one of the biggest tests for the former president that we have seen so far this summer.
Especially coming out of these January 6th public hearings. And you and I, Kristen, we've had this conversation through the summer after each of these hearings is what was the impact going to be, especially on Republican voters and whether they chose to turn away from Donald Trump. Well, this is the best poll that will be taken yet because it's going to be at least Arizona Republican voters here who have very clear options. Not only, you said it there, Carrie Lake, who's running for governor, Mark Fincham, Secretary of State, Abe Hamadeh for Attorney General, Blake Masters for U.S. Senate. Each of these four candidates with Trump's blessing, he campaigned here in Arizona alongside of them just 1 week ago. And I think that this is going to be a testament to whether voters in this state, a state that has shown a willingness to vote Democrat in the general election, whether they believe or want this more Trump-aligned figures to continue to represent them as their nominees. You know, I did have a conversation, or attempted a conversation would be the better way to describe it, with Carrie Lake, who is the Trump-backed candidate here, because over the last 2 weeks, she has propagated the idea that there are fraud and, quote, irregularities already in her primary for governor here in the state of Arizona. But I tried to press her on any specific allegations or specific evidence, and she was not able to provide any or refused to provide any. Instead, she said that she was not going to share them with us. And so I turned and I asked, well, then have you turned them over to respective authorities? And she refused to answer that question. I did reach out here in the last couple hours to not only elections officials here in Maricopa County, but also the Arizona Secretary of State's office. They said that they have received no concerns from Lake or her campaign here in what is expected not only for this governor's race, but those other races I mentioned to be tight races. The big question here, Kristen, is how many of those folks that first came out in 2020 to vote for Donald Trump and were newly registered voters, how many of them are not only willing to show up for midterms, but a midterm primary in the dead of August? That is the question that we're watching here at the polls today, Kristen.
Yeah, it is a key question. And it's just striking to hear Carrie Lake, this former television news anchor, repeat the same strategy that we saw from former President Trump and essentially try to argue that there's already been some type of election fraud with absolutely no evidence, unable to back it up. You did such a great job pressing her on that. And it's also worth noting, Vaughn, of course, that the race for the Senate in Arizona, two election deniers as well, Blake Masters, Jim Lehman, it really underscores the fact that it seems like this part of the party is thriving in these primaries.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And I think it's important to note, you know, Governor Doug Ducey, who, much to the chagrin of Donald Trump, certified Arizona's Joe Biden win here. He has weighed in the governor's race, backing Karen Taylor Robeson, who is really in this mano a mano, the alternative to Carrie Lake. but he hasn't endorsed in the U.S. Senate race because you just said it. Jim Layman and Blake Masters both told me that they would have objected to the certification if they were in the U.S. Senate at the time. I should note Doug Ducey has endorsed a gentleman named Bo Lane in the Secretary of State's race who is looking to take on Mark Fincham, who is the guy you'll recognize as with the mustache, the cowboy hat, a fellow election denier who's running alongside Lake and those others. Kristen.
All right. Well, it's been a busy time for you, Vaughn. Thank you for all of your great reporting. Shaq, let me turn to you. You are tracking the gubernatorial race there, the other races there. Tudor Dixon seemed to defect this morning when asked about her feelings about the 2020 election. It's an indication that she might be pivoting to the general. She's been endorsed by Trump. Of course, she's also been endorsed by Betsy DeVos, which has been quite notable and controversial to some voters there. Talk about the significance of this.
Well, that's a point that you heard from some of her opponents in this primary race. Kevin Rinke made that point to me yesterday with one of the answers she gave on Sunday. And, you know, this race has been close and it's going to be unpredictable when you listen to what the candidates have to say. That endorsement coming from former President Trump on Friday. We also know yesterday they appeared together on telephone for a tele-town hall. Trump and Tudor Dixon. Dixon telling me if she is on a path to victory, that endorsement is going to play a major role there. So that is something that we'll watch and we'll continue to see. But former President Trump yesterday on that town hall said, Dixon is my only candidate. I am fully behind her and she has my complete and total endorsement. But then there's also the primary race that you're seeing here in Michigan's 3rd congressional district. That's, of course, the race between Representative Peter Meyer, who is one of the 10 House Republicans to support the impeachment of President Trump after January 6th in that insurrection and Capitol riots there. He's receiving that challenge by Trump-backed candidate John Gibbs. I spoke to both of them today, and one thing that they were asked about was about the idea of Democratic groups getting involved in the Republican primary here to the tune of about $425,000 in ads against Gibbs, but calling him too conservative for this state. I want you to listen to what Peter Meyer told me about that. That more than $400,000 painting you as a strong conservative, isn't that something that you could see as a boost to your campaign?
I don't know. I don't spend a lot of time thinking about that. I spend time thinking about how to get out to more places, meet more voters, get more folks to be turned out to come vote for me. That's what I'm thinking about. That's what my team's thinking about. I don't know what the Democrats' deliberations are, what they're thinking or not thinking. I don't really care about it too much.
That was Gibbs and his response. I asked him instead about what Meyer told me, which was the point that he said he thinks that Democratic groups are doing this because he believes that they believe that Gibbs is a more beatable candidate in the general election. But he said that the Democrats are playing a dangerous game here, that they're being hypocritical by pouring money into this race when he says it's important and it's about preserving democracy because of Gibbs' baseless allegations about the 2020 election results, Kristen.
Yeah, Shaq, and I can tell you I've spoken to a number of Democrats who think this strategy is incredibly risky and potentially runs the risk of not only having some of these folks get into office, but making Democrats look hypocritical, particularly in the wake of the January 6th committee hearing. Shaq Brewster, thank you so much for your great reporting and fantastic interview there with John Gibbs. Steve, I got to go to you and the big board. You have been watching a number of these statewide races tonight. Tonight has a little bit of everything, which is what makes it so exciting. It's a key test for Trump. It's a test for progressives. It's a test on abortion as well. What are you watching for?
Yeah, I mean, the Trump test, I think, front and center here. You're just talking about that Peter Meyer race there in Michigan. We've been keeping tabs here on the 10 House Republicans who last year voted to impeach Donald Trump. What's their fate in 2022? You can see as you start to tick through the primary season this year, a number of them just opted to retire and not even run again, not even face Republican primary voters. So far, before today, there are two who had voted to impeach Trump who ended up facing Republican primary voters. Notably, David Valadao in California got through that top two primary in California and into the general election. Tom Rice in South Carolina did not get through his primary. He was trounced. A key difference between those two outcomes, Donald Trump weighed in the Rice race. He endorsed Rice's opponent. Rice's opponent won. Donald Trump stayed out of the David Valadao race in California. Valadao survived that primary. So I think when you take a look at today's races, whether it's Meyer in Western Michigan, or you've got Jamie Herrera Butler and Dan Newhouse both out in Washington State. You've got three up today, three Republicans who voted to impeach facing primary electors today. Trump has weighed in all three of those races. So it puts it more, at least on paper, in the Tom Rice category than in the Valadao category. If you're just looking through, you just saw there John Gibbs, the Trump-endorsed candidate, against Meyer. Joe Kent. Now, remember, in Washington, this is sort of a jungle primary. Both parties on the same ballot here. But Joe Kent is the Republican who Trump has backed here against Herrera Butler. And then also in the 4th District, Lauren Culp is the Republican who Trump is backing against Dan Newhouse. So you've got Trump weighing in here in these races. And the only Republican after tonight left on the primary calendar who voted to impeach Trump yet to have her verdict, that would be Liz Cheney. That's 2 weeks from now. So you can imagine she will be watching these races closely tonight. Maybe a clue about her fate 2 weeks from now, because, again, Trump has certainly weighed in her race as well.
He certainly has, Steve. And let me she's trailing by double digits, 20 points, I think, in one of the latest polls. Steve, let me just do a quick follow up with you, because it's not insignificant, right, that the races in Washington State, as you say, are open. It's the top two vote getters. These are nonpartisan primaries. So does that change the dynamic potentially?
Yeah, it's interesting, because if you take a look, this race in the 3rd District, I think, is interesting because Trump has backed Joe Kent. But there's another, there's this list would go on if I could scroll here. But there's another Republican candidate here who had originally vowed to get out of the race if Trump endorsed somebody else. Trump comes along and endorses Kemp. She stayed in the race, and there's an independent group that has poured $1.5 million into ads supporting her. So a little unclear what the motivation of the group is, who exactly is behind it, but I think it clouds the picture a little bit here. And if you're Herrera Butler, that has been a positive development for you, because potentially it could split some of that vote up.
Oh, that is interesting. And we're going to be up late watching all of this. Steve Kornacki, thank you so much for setting the stakes for tonight. Really appreciate it. Good to see you. And of course, we will see you and all of our reporters tonight on our Meet the Press election special. And we're also going to talk to a number of the candidates we were just mentioning, the dueling Democrats in Michigan, the independent candidate in Missouri, and the Republican Senate hopeful in Arizona, who is pushing back on election fraud, just to name a few. You do not want to miss this. That's tonight, starting at 9 p.m. Eastern. Next, a U.S. drone strike takes out the leader of Al-Qaeda. We'll discuss what it means for the future of counterterrorism efforts with retired general, former director of the CIA, and commander of U.S. Central Command, David Petraeus. You're watching Meet the Press now. Stay with us. Welcome back. Last night, President Biden announced the United States killed Ayman al-Zawahiri, an al-Qaeda terrorist who played a key role in the planning of the 9/11 attacks and who became al-Qaeda's leader after the death of Osama bin Laden. According to a senior administration official, U.S. intelligence was able to locate al-Zawahiri in a Taliban-supported safe house in downtown Kabul, raising questions and concerns that the Taliban is not upholding counterterrorism-related commitments it made as part of the United States withdrawal from Afghanistan. The strike comes as we near the one-year anniversary of that chaotic American withdrawal, which President Biden defended in his remarks last night.
When I ended our military mission in Afghanistan almost a year ago, I made the decision that after 20 years of war, the United States no longer needed thousands of boots on the ground in Afghanistan to protect America from terrorists who seek to do us harm. And I made a promise to the American people that we continue to conduct effective counterterrorism operations in Afghanistan and beyond. We've done just that.
I am joined now by retired General David Petraeus, former director of the CIA and commander of U.S. Central Command. General, thank you so much for joining me this afternoon. Really appreciate it.
Pleasure.
So what is your reaction to the news, and how important of a blow is this operationally to al-Qaeda, or is this more symbolic given that he was 71 years old?
Well, it's a bit of both. It's a very significant blow. It's a huge achievement by our intelligence and counterterrorism communities. It is significant in the sense that he did in recent years declare, for example, a new affiliate in the Indian subcontinent. He has continued to exhort his followers at various times to attack infidels and so forth. But on the other hand, he was not issuing direct guidance. He wasn't guiding operations. He was no longer as active as he was when he was the brains of Al-Qaeda, as he used to be described, partnering with Osama bin Laden since the late 1990s and planning and then overseeing the execution of the attacks, as you mentioned, including the 9/11 attacks, but also the USS Cole and also the bombing of the embassies in East Africa, among a number of others. So it's a very significant blow, but it also reflects in a way the fact that Al-Qaeda has been decentralized very considerably, and it also has been degraded, but we still must keep an eye on it. And particularly now that we see that the Taliban are not living up to their part of the Doha Agreement, the commitment to not shelter national extremists on their soil.
Well, let me actually, to that point, my colleague Savannah Guthrie on the Today Show did ask National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan about that, about the fact that he was being harbored by Taliban leaders. Let me just play you a little bit of what he had to say and then get your reaction on the other side. Take a look.
We believe that there were senior members of the Haqqani network who are affiliated with the Taliban who did know that Zawahiri was in Kabul. There may have been other members of the Taliban who did not know. We have already been engaged with the Taliban, and I'm not going to preview any further actions that we will take to ensure that the Taliban lives up to its commitments not to allow any external plotting from Afghanistan, but rest assured the United States will be vigilant on that.
General, he says the United States will be vigilant, but what actions do you think need to be taken? For obvious reasons, he's keeping his cards very close to the vest. But can you be specific about what you think needs to happen, given that we have determined that the Taliban was hiding this Al-Qaeda leader in a safe harbor?
First of all, I think it was a very fair assessment that he made. The person harboring him was really the number two in this group of the Taliban and the Haqqani network. Siraj Haqqani has a 10 million bounty on his head as well, I might add. He's also the acting minister of interior, but it's not net certain that the Taliban leader overall knew this was going on. That said, this clearly reflects the imperative to keep an eye and pressure on extremists in Afghanistan who are trying to take advantage of the fact that the Taliban are now in charge. And I should note that the group that is most worrisome actually is not Al-Qaeda's senior leadership. It's actually the Islamic State Khorasan group, the affiliate of the Islamic State that's established in Afghanistan and Western Pakistan. They're the ones carrying out the most significant attacks in Afghanistan, trying to foment sectarian civil war there.
Well, and General, as you know, when President Biden withdrew troops a year ago from Afghanistan, it was widely seen as a botched effort. But one of the concerns was exactly what you point to. Would the U.S. have the same level of ability to engage in counterterrorism, the type of operation that was carried out over the weekend? Now, the White House would say, look, this is a vindication that the strategy is, in fact, working. What say you about this? Do you have any concerns that without a robust footprint there, that the United States doesn't have enough eyes and ears on the ground?
Well, first of all, I would not assume that we don't have a network still active there. One presumes that some of the confirmation process and other activities have been facilitated by that. The question, though, is not whether we could carry out single attacks such as this. In fact, I predicted we would be able to carry out over the horizon attacks and operations. The challenge is if you have to carry out a campaign. We don't see a need for that just yet. But as our chairman of the Joint Chiefs said, you know, it only takes 6 months to a couple of years to see these groups reconstitute themselves. And I think the concern, therefore, is over the longer term, not at the immediate time right now. But again, a huge tribute to those in our intelligence and counterterrorism communities for what they've done. This is a very significant blow in the brains behind Al-Qaeda for many, many decades.
General, before I let you go, I do have to get your reaction to this breaking news that we are tracking, which is that House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has now landed in Taiwan. As you know, China has had some very strong language warning her not to go. She's there shining a light on the human rights abuses by China, on the situation on the ground. What is your take on her trip? Are you concerned that this might inflame tensions that are already pretty high right now?
You know, there's a lot of different takes on this, but the one that I think is generally broadly agreed is that there will be repercussions as a result of this. There sort of have to be. Again, President Xi is in the final months of his own reelection campaign in late October, early November. The party Congress will convene and reelect him for an unprecedented third term. He hoped that everything would be nice and smooth. It has not been, given Russia, given Ukraine, given the economy slowing down, given the real estate developers collapse and so forth. So this will add to that, but the pressure will be on him. He will have to take actions. And I think they won't just be in the near term.
Military actions, General? Military actions?
No, you'll see live fire exercises. You'll see demonstrations. I don't think no one wants to see a confrontation. And I think each side has been very careful to avoid that. Even the flight path of Speaker Pelosi's plane went out east of the Philippines to come in from the other side, not the most direct route from Singapore.
General David Petraeus, thank you so much for joining us on a very big news day and for helping us to understand all of these complicated issues. Good to see you. And still ahead, reaction from the U.S. and China to Speaker Nancy Pelosi's controversial and defiant trip to Taiwan. We're going to speak to Andrea Mitchell. You're watching Meet the Press Now. Stay with us. Welcome back. The major issue on the ballot today in Kansas is abortion. As voters get to choose whether or not their state constitution will explicitly protect abortion rights. But the language could be confusing. Voting yes on the amendment means not protecting abortion, and voting no means protecting the right. It's a vote that could be very, very close. NBC's Dasha Burns has been talking to voters as they make their decision on this critical amendment.
We are probably looking at a pretty tight race here, and regardless of the outcome, this is going to be significant not just for Kansas, but for the entire nation, as the voters voting behind me here are going to be among the first in the country to cast a ballot on this issue since Roe v. Wade was overturned. And in order to get here, voters have had to navigate a lot of information, a lot of misinformation, including just yesterday, misleading text message sent to Kansans claiming that voting yes would protect a woman's reproductive choices, when in fact a yes vote on the Value Them Both amendment would strip the Kansas state constitution of protections for abortion rights and potentially open the door for restrictions or potentially, as many abortion rights activists fear, a ban on abortion in the state of Kansas. Still, the folks that came out here today are determined to make their voices heard. Take a listen to just a little bit of our conversations with voters.
I found it very complicated to try and figure out. We spent a lot of time doing a little bit of research and trying to understand what the amendment actually meant.
I spent some time researching just to make sure we made the right choice. And my husband was just in voting too, and we definitely made the right choice. It was very easy once we did our research.
I wish they would use simple language. I understand they have to use language that can be legal, you know, but for me, it's hard to understand.
What we're looking for is not only whether the yes or no vote wins, but also the turnout here in Kansas. How big of a driving factor is the abortion issue when it comes to getting voters to the polls? I can tell you here in Gardner, Kansas, they are already seeing an increase compared to the last primary in a midterm year. And early voting numbers show a more than 200% increase from 2018.
All right, Dasha Burns, thank you for that. For more on what's at stake in Kansas and tonight's primary races, I'm joined by my panel, Politico White House correspondent and Playbook co-author Eugene Daniels, Republican strategist Brad Todd, and Democratic pollster Margie Omero. Thanks to all of you for being here. Margie, let me give you this question first. What are you watching for in Kansas, and how much weight should we be giving this, given that it is the first time abortion is going to be on the ballot since Roe was overturned?
Well, of course, it's important because it's important to protect the right to an abortion around the country. And this is what polls around the country show, a majority of voters support. I think when there's a vote like this, people want to put a lot of importance on it, like it's a special congressional election. Like, this is the answer to the entire election season. I think we should really focus on Kansas, what this means in Kansas. Kansas is a disproportionately Republican state in August, in November, whenever it is. If abortion rights opponents were confident in their position, why make the ballot language so complicated that people don't know what it is that they're, you saw in the segment, that they don't know what it is that they're voting for? Why put it on the primary ballot when there's bound to be lower turnout and fewer competitive statewide races? So we'll see what happens here, but I think it's important to put it in the context of what it means in the state.
Yeah, I mean, Brad, what about that? Given that it is so complicated, and you hear that turnout is already up 200% early voting since 2018, we don't know what those votes are going to say, but it seems like these voters are energized to weigh in on something. What do you make of this?
Well, I think having it in August actually is a good thing because the ballot's less crowded. Voters can spend a lot more time focusing on it. The airways aren't cluttered with a lot of advertising for other things. So it becomes a much more primary focus of voters going in. Because these things get complicated because the lawyers in the Secretary of State's office make them complicated. That's what constitutional amendment language always is.
They traditionally
all of us on the campaign side, yes. side always fight them tooth and nail about how to word it. But all this referendum does is say, do you as a Kansas voter want to have control over abortion policy in the state? Do you want to remove it from judges and give it to the people and their elected representatives? And so I think you're going to see a pretty wide coalition support it. Kansas is a state that abortion has divided the Republican Party for years, actually, there. Yeah. It's been a big issue there, but I think you'll see a lot of people say, yes, we want the voters back.
Eugene, when I talk to Democrats and I ask them, what are they watching for in tonight's races? It's not these battles between Democrats. It's not even the tests for progressives, some of the things that we're watching for. It's this vote in Kansas.
Yeah, because they're hoping that they will get a sense of how the American people feel about this. This is our first test, though, as Marty said, you know, this is about Kansas. I will say, you know, talking to folks over the last couple of days, they tell me that as they're watching and they're looking at how this vote ends up turning out, you're going to see whether or not people think that the Supreme Court went too far with the giving it back to the states and then banning abortion. Because even when you talk to people who say they're pro-life, sometimes people say they're pro-life but pro-choice, where they still want a woman to be able to choose in some instances for there to be exceptions. And so this will be a test of part of that.
Nationally, polls show an increase. First of all, even before the Supreme Court decision, a majority supported the right to an abortion. That surged after the Supreme Court decision. Motivation among Democrats has surged. Motivation around this issue has surged. The favorability toward the Supreme Court has dropped. I mean, it is poll after poll after poll nationally. It could not be more consistent.
So tonight is a test for abortion. It is also, all of these primaries have been a test of former President Trump's staying power. Is he still a kingmaker? But Brad, boy, tonight may be his biggest test yet. He's endorsed more than 30 candidates. More than 30 of them are election deniers.
Well, it's a big night for primaries in general, but I think people are going to be watching the two races in Washington State with Dan Newhouse and Jamie Herrera Butler in particular.
Two Republicans who voted to impeach President Trump.
Right, two incumbent Republicans. Yep. I think that those two races are going to be largely, they're going to drive opinions about the president's endorsement tonight more than anything else. I think you've also got an interesting race in Michigan in that you have J Street and a lot more less progressive pro-Israel groups going against each other in the 13th district. I think two Democratic incumbents, Haley Stevens and Levin, Andy Levin, I think that's perhaps one of the most interesting primaries that we're not talking about tonight. And I think that it'll tell us a lot about where the Democratic Party is. Are they pushing back on their own progressives?
Well, and two governors.
We're going to talk to them tonight, by the way, both of them. We're going to have on our election night special.
So
on News
in
now.
Two governors races, Trump has endorsed one candidate and Pence has endorsed another candidate in two of the primaries tonight. I mean, that if that's not a test of Trump's power as an endorser, then I don't know what is. And you were talking about the media markets in Kansas. In Kansas City media market, you have the two Erics. And of course, that's what Trump just, you know, loves chaos. His, carefully researched endorsement of anyone named Eric is going to be at play there, too.
And you had some wonderful reporting in Politico about what was behind former President Trump's decision to endorse Eric when the two front runners are Eric Schmidt and Eric Reitens, of course.
Somebody else on the ballot
governor.
Named Eric, too.
I shouldn't be living out the third.
Choose your own
Eric.
Adventure.
I know. But to some extent, I mean, you have some Republicans saying this is making a mockery of the Trump Trump endorsement at a time, frankly, Eugene, when he's had mixed results in these primaries.
And I think that's part of why you're seeing him just go with the Erics, because he's saying, you know, this is going to be for the people to decide, but in this one particular race, right? Because it's, it looks very close, and he does know that he's had these mixed results as we've seen and gone forward and forward. And as you, as he talks about being a winner, he's not someone who ever wants to be seen as a loser. And when he is going against what used to be the establishment, people like Mike Pence, his former vice president, you see a tugging in the Republican Party about what it means to be a Republican.
I mean, he picks candidates to endorse, kind of like I pick, my like Sweet 16 in college basketball. Like, I don't know, I guess I'm going to pick this person. I mean, that's his sort of level of detail and his mixed results.
The most, right?
Right, that's true. If I had the teams tell me I was great, then that would be the way he would.
I don't know if the process is the same as you go through, but I do think he likes. I do think he likes to have a rooting interest in every game, you know.
And but so, does it undercut? Does it make a mockery of his endorsement?
You know, I think only his voters and people who support him most ardently and look mostly to his endorsements, only they can decide that. What we see mostly in primaries is that the president's sort of he tabs someone, right? It's a first look. He can cause people to take a look at someone, but they end up making up their own mind as they look at other candidates in the race.
Marjorie, how big of a test is tonight for progressive candidates? You have Cori Bush, Rashida Tlaib, both facing challengers who are both saying, look, you guys have been very focused on getting headlines more so than the policy and the substance. How critical of a night is this
progressives? I think on the Democratic side, we don't have the same kind of theatrics that are going on the Republican side. And so it's up for each district and each set of voters to, you know, to decide for themselves. I don't know if you can say that there's a bigger story to be told based on what's happening on the Democratic side tonight.
What will you be watching for tonight?
The gubernatorial races are really interesting, especially in Arizona and Missouri, right? Because you have people who are election deniers. Actually, in Arizona, both of them on the Republican side are election deniers, pushing President Trump's lie about the election. And in Missouri, Eric Greitens, I used to live in Missouri years ago, and Eric Greitens is scandal-plagued, right?
Yes.
And so this is someone who, if wins, Republicans are very nervous about losing.
Very quickly, because we're almost out of time, but one thing that's looming over tonight and the primaries in general is President Biden. And he now has a mixed record. He might be close to getting this big piece of legislation passed that he's been working on, the Inflation Reduction Act, as it is now called. And then he came out last night and announced that he had killed this Al-Qaeda leader. Brad, do you think Republicans are reassessing the climate for Democrats, given some of these things?
Absolutely not. Two-thirds of the American public thinks that Joe Biden's done it. They disagree with his policies. They don't think he's done a good job on inflation. They don't think he's done a good job on gas prices. They generally don't trust him on foreign policy. I'll be glad to have Joe Biden as a referendum in every race we face.
Final word, Marty.
The third one you missed was a drop in gas prices. So the biggest drop in gas prices in a decade. Look, ultimately, if they're not reassessing the climate, they should be, because you have changes, fluctuations, and narrowing of the generic ballot, or Democrats, you know, surging in the generic ballot. You have Senate candidates and gubernatorial candidates, you know, really struggling on the Republican side. And you have election deniers. Those who aren't out front as election deniers in some of these races are just election denier adjacent or election denier avoidant, just trying to avoid the question.
But well, enough about Stacey Abrams.
This is a great conversation that set us up for a very exciting night. Thanks to all of you, Eugene, Brad, and Margie. Appreciate it. Andrea Mitchell will be here next. Plus, Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal joins us as two of the country's most well-known progressives, as we were just talking about, face primary challenges tonight. You're watching Meet the Press now. Stay with us. Welcome back. Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi arrived in Taiwan earlier today, despite threats from China, whose leaders claim the self-governed island is part of their sovereign territory. China's Ministry of Foreign Affairs condemned the visit, saying it violated the One China principle. And state media reports the Chinese Army will conduct 3 days of military exercises and training around the region. In a Washington Post opinion piece published shortly after her arrival, Pelosi defended her visit, citing China's human rights record and its crackdown on Hong Kong. She wrote, quote, "We cannot stand by as the CCP proceeds to threaten Taiwan and democracy itself." Pelosi has received congressional support from both sides of the aisle. Today, 26 Republican senators issued a statement supporting her trip to Taiwan. But the visit has caused a headache for the White House, which has signaled its concern with the visit as the administration now navigates an escalation in tensions between Washington and Beijing. Joining me now is NBC's chief foreign affairs correspondent, Andrea Mitchell, who has been all over this trip. Andrea, thank you for joining me.
No, pleasure.
You have been sort of tracking the reaction and fallout from the White House, specifically John Kirby, briefing reporters today. What are they saying about this visit?
Well, they keep asking him repeatedly, well, you know, why are you saying that this is not a change? There's obviously tension between the administration and Pelosi over this. Mm-hmm. We know this informally, but publicly they're saying she's independent. She's a separate branch of government. She has every right to go. Speakers have gone before. Of course, the speaker who went before was Newt Gingrich in 1997. That was 25 years ago. But the fact is she's always been a hawk on Taiwan. In 1991, famously, she went to Tiananmen Square just, you know, 2 years after the uprising there and after the killings of all of those people, and furled a banner with two fellow Congress members. The police showed up, they blocked the camera crews, and it was quite an incident. Mm-hmm. So that shows, again, and just a couple of years ago, 2019, she tweeted that video from 1991 to show her solidarity. That was on the 30th anniversary of Tiananmen. Now, this is still evolving as we speak. There are reports in official Chinese media that they awakened our ambassador, Nicholas Burns,
oh my gosh,
in the middle of the night to call him in and, quote, demarsh him, which in diplomatic terms means, you know, call him on the carpet, read him the riot act over this. And they flew fighter jets right up against the line of what Taiwan claims its airspace. So live fire exercises that have been happening for a couple of days, which hadn't happened in decades and decades. That was the last time. It was 1995 and 6. And now they're saying there'll be more exercises to come tomorrow.
And what is the potential fallout beyond everything that you're laying out, Andrea? I mean, the United States, and we've been reporting on this, the Biden administration does have some concerns both for Speaker Pelosi's safety and security, but also for the potential diplomatic fallout here. What else could you potentially envision happening in the wake of this?
Well, certainly the concern would be that there'd be some sort of military confrontation. As John Kirby has said, it could be accidental. It could be, you know, misconstrued, one side, the other side, the U.S. caught in the middle. The U.S. has sent warships, notably the Ronald Reagan, that's a carrier group, but also other warships that they're not specifying to the Taiwan Strait. That's a fairly narrow strait. And there are areas there that are very close with the outlying islands of Quemoy and Matsu, just a couple of miles from southern China, Fujian province. In any case, she is going to be meeting at around 8 o'clock Eastern tonight. She's going to be meeting with Taiwan's president, also a woman, by the way, well-regarded for her support for democratic principles. Then she meets with the parliament and then has a news conference before leaving at about 5 o'clock Eastern tomorrow. So we're hoping she got a little bit of sleep, not much, but stuff is still happening.
And just quickly, Andrea, what are you anticipating we'll hear from her in that news conference?
I think she will say that there have been Congress members who have gone before. This is not a change of policy. I support democracy. And basically, the administration agrees that once this leaked out that she was going, and they did not announce it, it was off the record, they didn't announce it until after she landed, but the concern is that somehow Beijing will get too aggressive and that will be a major problem, a confrontation between our major economic and military rival, China. It'll make the war in Ukraine look like nothing.
Mm. Andrea, thank you. No one knows this stuff better than you. It's so great to see you. Really appreciate it.
Good to be here, Kristen. We're watching you all night, by the way, with the election coverage.
Yes, yes, and we'll be watching you on Nightly News, Andrea. Thank you. We'll be right back. Welcome back. As we count down to tonight's primary results, some familiar progressive faces are on the ballot tonight, facing down more moderate challengers. In Michigan, member of the progressive group dubbed the Squad, Rashida Tlaib, is facing three challengers, and another so-called Squad member, Missouri's Cori Bush, is facing a moderate Senate state senator in her first re-election bid. I'm joined now by the leader of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, Congresswoman from Washington, Pramila Jayapal. Congresswoman, thank you so much for joining me. Appreciate it.
It's great to be with you.
So as I just laid out, two of your fellow progressive colleagues are facing challenges across the country, in fact, tonight. But we named two of them, Rashida Tlaib and Cori Bush. Are you worried about their prospects tonight? And what do you say to their challengers who are basically making the case that they are too focused on sort of the core principles of progressivism? They don't speak to a broad enough swath of voters, and they aren't focused on getting things done in Washington.
Well, Kristen, I would just say that these are two very effective members of Congress. They represent their districts extremely well. Voters selected them because they represent their districts extremely well. They know their districts, and they brought home enormous benefits to their districts. Rashida Tlaib, for example, has been one of the most effective advocates I know on the issue of water. You know, her district in Michigan was dealing with lead in water pipes and the inability of people to be able to drink clean water. And she has been relentless in making sure she brought home enormous amounts of money and got those provisions into the American Rescue Plan, and continuing to advocate for even more in the reconciliation bill. Same with Cori Bush, you know, advocating around ensuring that people didn't get kicked out of their homes and that a moratorium continued to ensure that people were not going to be kicked out of their homes. So I think they're going to do well tonight.
Let me ask you, though, because you all wanted to see, of course, the infrastructure bill and then what was called Build Back Better get passed together. That never happened. And so there was movement on infrastructure. And now we see this sort of retooled version of that, the Inflation Reduction Act that was just announced by Senator Schumer and Senator Manchin. Do you have any regrets? And do your fellow progressives have any regrets about not supporting that early on and trying to take action on that earlier, given now the threats to some of your colleagues?
Let me just reframe that, because actually we did pass both infrastructure and Build Back Better through the House. And if you remember, when we got the infrastructure bill, there was no Build Back Better bill. We insisted that we had to have that. We drafted out the language in the bill and passed that bill through the House on the promise that the senators made to the president of the United States that they would move forward the president's economic agenda. Progressives have always been for the president's economic agenda. That's why we passed Build Back Better. And this bill that the Senate is now taking up 9 months later, which is the president's part of the president's economic agenda, has many of the components that we insisted were in the House bill.
So you'll support it, Congresswoman? You'll support it? It's not everything.
Absolutely, I'm going to support it. No, and actually, I think we have a lot of unity that while it isn't everything, we need 50 votes in the Senate. And unfortunately, we didn't have 50 votes in the Senate for the president's economic agenda. So we will take what we can get with 50 votes. And every single one of these pieces that is in the Inflation Reduction Act is extremely important and is a big step forward. So, yes, I'm going to support
it. It's still not clear that you have 50 votes. All eyes are on Senator Sinema. I know she is in a different chamber, but are you hearing anything about her reaction? I was talking to a source close to Senator Sinema who noted the fact that this piece of legislation does include that tax provision that she's opposed to. Are you worried she's going to come out and say, I can't get behind this?
Well, I'm relying on Senator Schumer to bring his chamber and all 50 Democrats along. Senator Sinema did have a lot of input into the provisions that were in the original Build Back Better bill. I hope they're talking to her, because, listen, Kristen, we need to get this done for the American people. It's going to reduce costs. It's going to make sure people have health care. And it's going to invest in the urgent crisis of climate change. We got to get this done.
Finally, I have to ask you about this Democratic strategy of propping up some candidates who they believe would be easier to beat in a general election. John Gibbs is the perfect example tonight. He's obviously running against Peter Meyer. Do you support that strategy, or do you think it's too risky or too hypocritical, as some of your colleagues have said?
Well, I don't like the idea of propping up election deniers. I just don't like it. I have to be honest. I don't want to second guess the D-Trip. I haven't looked at their polling. I don't know what kind of a difference, you know, their strategy is going to make. But on a values perspective, I don't like it. And I'll tell you, Kristen, I was one of the very few people that actually thought Donald Trump could win for the presidency back in 2016. Everybody told me I was crazy, but I felt like that could happen because people unfortunately buy into this bully tactic and all of the horrible things that he was saying, the divisive things he was saying. So I just don't think we can rely, you know, we can think that we know how voters are going to react. And I think it's dangerous.
And very quickly, because we're almost out of time, in Kansas tonight, do you see this as a critical test for the extent to which the abortion issue may be energizing for voters, for Democrats in the fall?
It's definitely something we're going to watch closely. I don't think it's the be all and end all. If it doesn't work out the way we want, because primary elections are tough, not everyone votes. But I think November will be different. But certainly we're watching it closely.
All right. We covered a lot of ground on this election day. Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal, thank you so much for joining us and for your perspective.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you for being with us this hour.